Picture a house split between two worlds, one half in Nazi Germany, the other in Czechoslovakia. In March 1933, a young Jewish woman and her mother slipped through this architectural loophole, escaping Hitler's tightening grip without passports or permission. That woman was Hannah Arendt, who would later become one of the 20th century's most influential philosophers. Her harrowing flight wasn't just a personal survival story. It became the foundation for understanding a brutal paradox that still haunts us. We proclaim human rights as universal, yet refugees discover these rights evaporate the moment they cross a border. What happens when the very governments meant to protect human dignity become the ones who decide whose humanity counts? Arendt's journey from Berlin to Paris, then to a muddy internment camp at Gurs, and finally to America revealed a devastating truth. Without citizenship, you have no rights at all. France initially seemed like refuge, but as Hitler's shadow spread across Europe, French society turned hostile. Refugees became undesirables, subject to arbitrary detention and deportation. When war erupted in 1939, Arendt's husband was imprisoned as an enemy alien, and she soon followed, not for any crime, but simply for existing without papers. Her escape from Gurs led to months sleeping on floors in abandoned buildings, joining thousands of desperate people with nowhere to go. Then came an unexpected moment of grace. Walking down a street in Montauban, she spotted her husband in the crowd. Their reunion, against all odds, renewed what she called her violent courage of life, the stubborn refusal to surrender hope even when the world offers none. Through extraordinary persistence and luck, Arendt reached New York in 1941, but her experience left an intellectual scar. In her 1951 masterwork, she concluded that refugees discover the abstract nakedness of being human was their greatest danger. Beautiful declarations about human dignity mean nothing when you're stateless. States protect their citizens. Everyone else exists in a legal void. In October 1992, Yale law professor Harold Coe visited Guantanamo Bay and couldn't sleep for weeks. Beyond checkpoints and guard towers, Haitian refugees were crammed into concrete blocks with garbage bags taped over windows. The stench of overflowing toilets mixed with jet noise and gunfire. At night, 2-foot-long banana rats crawled over sleeping people. These refugees had fled Haiti's brutal military regime after the 1991 coup. The Coast Guard intercepted them at sea, conducting refugee screenings, often minutes-long interviews by untrained personnel. Of 21,461 Haitians intercepted over 9 years, only 6 entered America. The despair was so systematic that detainees debated collective suicide. Coe stood before the Supreme Court. "Ours is a nation of refugees. Most of our ancestors came here by boat. If they could do this to the Haitians, they could do this to any of us." The government's response was coldly legalistic. The Refugee Convention didn't apply on the high seas. Judge Sterling Johnson ordered HIV-positive Haitians released, declaring their detention serves no purpose other than to punish them for being sick. But the Supreme Court ruled 8-1 against the refugees in a decision scholars called the Dred Scott case of immigration law. Thailand and Tanzania explicitly cited this case when closing their own borders. Guantanamo's legal ambiguity, where Cuba retained ultimate sovereignty while America exercised complete jurisdiction and control, created exactly what Arendt had warned about, a place where rights simply don't exist. Mohammed Al-Ghazi survived Iraqi prison torture and paid smugglers $2,000 for a harrowing 36-hour crossing to Christmas Island, waves threatening capsize, water flooding through cracks. Australian Navy interception brought brief relief. At Curtin Detention Center, detainees became numbers, enduring constant searches and isolation. After 11 months, Al-Ghazi received a temporary protection visa to Perth, but Australia's policy forbade bringing relatives. His wife, Ragid, decided to make the same journey with their children. The vessel Ragid boarded was so rotten, passengers demanded refunds. Indonesian police forced them aboard at gunpoint. 30 hours out, the engine failed during a storm. As the ship disintegrated, most of 400 passengers were trapped inside. Only 45 of a 100 initial survivors were rescued. Al-Ghazi's entire family drowned. He suffered a breakdown and temporary blindness. Immigration officials refused his request to travel to Indonesia, citing inability to return. The temporary protection visa policy, designed to deter refugees, actually increased dangerous crossings. Children arriving jumped from 111 to 1,563. Al-Ghazi blamed it directly. If we came here by permanent visa, it didn't happen. In 1993, thousands protested as Germany moved to eliminate constitutional asylum rights. Why? In 1948, haunted by Nazi atrocities, Germany's founders wrote the simplest asylum clause: persons persecuted on political grounds shall enjoy the right to asylum. For decades, claims stayed around 5,000 annually. But in 1980, a Turkish coup sent 92,000 asylum seekers to Germany. When the Berlin Wall fell, applications exploded to 438,000 by 1992, representing two-thirds of all European asylum claims for the entire 1980s-90s combined. Far-right violence surged, culminating in the Mulm firebombing that killed three Turkish Germans. The constitutional amendment passed overwhelmingly, allowing automatic rejection from countries with acceptable human rights and creating safe third country agreements. Claims plummeted to 122,210 by 1994. Germany's crisis signaled broader European trends: impossible visa requirements, accelerated rejections, detention in airport transit zones. By 2009, Greece rejected 99.95% of asylum claims. European airports became anomalous zones, legal limbos like Guantanamo, where refugees cannot access courts. This created a race to the bottom as countries competed to appear more unwelcoming than neighbors, pushing desperate people toward more dangerous routes. In northern Chad in 2004, Samantha Power interviewed Darfur refugees who had fled Sudan's Janjaweed militia. Their stories seemed too horrific to believe, which was exactly Arendt's warning: we dismiss atrocities as too awful to be true until it's too late. But Canada's Supreme Court proved Arendt wrong about something fundamental. The Singh v. Minister of Employment and Immigration decision transformed Canada's asylum system by establishing that constitutional rights apply to non-citizens. This prevents Canada from implementing measures common elsewhere: no excised offshore places, no punitive application deadlines. By enforcing refugee rights through the same constitutional mechanisms protecting citizens, Canada demonstrated what Arendt thought impossible. Consider Francine Patey, who witnessed Rwandan militiamen massacre her village's Tutsi population. After her husband was killed, she fled through war-torn Zaire using a fake Dutch passport. Canada's Singh-based system gave her the oral hearing, legal counsel, and judicial review that saved her life. Yet, even Canada isn't perfect. Its participation in interdiction measures, using clever questioning at foreign airports to catch travelers with false documents, undermines Singh's principles. Had such measures existed when Patey fled in 1997, she would have been stopped before reaching safety. Still, Canada's approach proves that constitutional protections can extend beyond citizenship without collapsing state authority. Sovereignty seems permanent, but sovereign states are recent inventions. In the 13th century, John Toole swore oaths to four different lords in a world without clear borders. City-states and leagues like the Hanseatic League, which included nearly 200 towns and could depose foreign kings, offered alternatives. Sovereign states prevailed because they simplified organization and foreign relations. Modern borders, distinguishing citizens from foreigners, only emerged between the 1880s and 1920s. Here's the paradox: sovereignty is constantly affirmed, yet routinely violated. Britain's 19th century anti-slavery campaign involved seizing Portuguese ships and burning slave vessels in Brazilian waters, blatant sovereignty violations for human rights. Today's responsibility to protect debates continue this tension. The question isn't whether sovereignty will disappear, but whether we can reshape it to serve humanity. If borders emerged for specific purposes, they can be reconstructed when those purposes change. Borders are human inventions, but suffering is universal. Every restrictive policy creates another Mohammed Al-Ghazi, another person whose family drowns because we valued sovereignty over compassion. Hannah Arendt fled through a house split between two countries, creating possibility where law said none existed. When you reduce someone to their papers, you've lost sight of their face, and once you can't see theirs, you can't see your own. The question isn't just who deserves protection, but whether sovereignty can coexist with universal human rights.